Did you hear the bloop? In 1997, an array of underwater microphones throughout the Pacific Ocean spanning more than 3,000 miles, placed by NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, picked up a strange, powerful, and extremely loud sound. Not only was it loud, said one writer, but the sound had a unique characteristic that came to be known as the bloop. For a while, there was speculation that somewhere down there in the 95% of the undersea world that remains unexplored, a giant species of animal, previously unknown to humankind, was declaring its presence. To be heard across the endless depths of the Pacific Ocean, it would have to be a creature that would dwarf even the most gigantic of the known species of whales. And the thing about the Pacific Ocean is, there is plenty of room down there for creatures of that size. Well, I'm sorry to ruin the frisson of excitement, but as NOAA had been confident of all along, it was not some gigantic unknown sea creature. It was the sound of an ice shelf breaking off of Antarctica, which happens with some regularity. So there go those scientists again, ruining another perfectly good story with, knowledge. But for some people, and even NOAA took almost 15 years to verify it, it was one of those moments when we are reminded of how little we know. It was a reminder that we are still discovering our home and how something new can happen anytime, or some new revelation can come that changes our view and our understanding of the world God has made. And it starts with a simple question, maybe only muttered, maybe not even articulated at all, but reverberating through our minds and our lives. What is it? At a fundamental level, the story of the covenant people and their journey through the wilderness has to do with the idea of home, where we come from, where we are, and the place where we believe we are going or that we dream of getting to. It's about food. It's about complaint. It's about displacement and hope. It's about God's provision and keeping the Sabbath, and there being enough for everyone as long as we are all looking out for each other. And the beginning of a new chapter starts with the Israelites looking at a new thing, previously unseen and unsuspected, and muttering a question that phonetically comes down to us as manhu, mana, manna, which means simply, what is it? In our time of displacement from the world we knew and more or less understood, or at least thought we did, a displacement which we know is temporary, but we also know that it's not a question of going back and picking up where we left off, but going forward and carrying on forever, at least just a little bit changed. Our time, too, is about home. In the sense that we all feel some sense of dislocation and we remember the world as it used to be, where we came from, and we long to arrive at last at that landing spot when this in-between time of unknowable duration will finally and definitively be over. And it will be eventually. And our story is still about displacement from what we knew, and it's about hope for what will be. And it's still about there being enough for everyone as long as we all look out for one another. And when we don't, human lives are at stake. It's still about food and need and memory and complaint that it ain't as good as it used to be. The Israelites were now saying that about their 400 years of hard servitude in bondage. Yeah, but at least the food was better. And it's still about God's provision. God provides, and God wants to feed you, and God wants to feed me, and God wants to feed all of humanity. And we want to see all of humanity fed. And we also want to have enough for ourselves and our loved ones. And there is enough if we will all look out for each other. No Christian finds it acceptable that people live and die in hunger based on where they were born or to whom or in what circumstances. Global economics, political machinations, and toxic chatter from radicals and reactionaries and misanthropes and nihilists cloud the point, but God gave us a cosmos and a planet and a human order in which there was enough for everyone as long as people lived with a sense of responsibility toward everyone else. When Moses was told that God was going to rain down bread from heaven, the gift was going to be that the people would be provided their fill and no more than their fill, their daily bread. And God remembered the Sabbath, so a double portion would be available and allowed the night before so that on the Sabbath people didn't have to go out and do the same gathering that they would do on the other days. The survival of your neighbors and the flourishing of the whole community would depend on each household both recognizing and caring that if any of them echoed the extraction and surplus practice of Pharaoh's world, gathering more than they needed for their own family for that day, essentially taking from those around them and trying to hoard it for their own families, their neighbors would be deprived and would go hungry. First to suffer would be those physically unable to go out and compete for the limited resource. Women with children, the elderly, people with physical and mental disabilities. If any suffered deprivation due to the faithlessness of some, the whole community would suffer. And once that began to happen, faithlessness to God and to each other becomes like a pandemic, spreading from household to household. Rumors and conspiracy theories pop up about who started it and why. And it doesn't discriminate about who's affected and who suffers, but as always, the least powerful are the most susceptible. And with astonishing immediacy, the bar of expectation lowers so drastically that what once was God's basic expectation of how we were supposed to be toward one another, everyone having enough, as long as we all look out for each other, is now talked about as if just that baseline expectation to look out for the needs of our neighbor is now somehow a supreme act of generosity that is rare and always unexpected, and that the most fawning appreciation is due to anyone who deigns to share some crumbs with the walking skeletons around them. It has been said by much wiser people than myself that for all the pain and for the miracle that it took to rescue the people of God from bondage in Egypt, it was easier to get the people out of Pharaoh's system than it was to get Pharaoh's system out of the people. Even today, we live with social, political, and economic realities that defy consensus. But no Christian finds it acceptable. There is no philosophy, theology, or spirituality that could be accurately described as Christian, in which it is acceptable that human beings live and die in hunger as a result of where or to whom or in what circumstances they were born. Eventually, the Israelites would settle, and God would stop the provision of the daily manna. The people would be responsible for their own provision, and it was time for it to be so. And the reality remained unchanged. There is enough for everyone if we will all look out for the needs of our neighbors. But still, even now, God provides daily bread. What is the manna? What is it that God rains down on you? What is the bread that God is giving you? Jesus told the disciples that the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who hires people to work the land in the early morning and then goes out and hires more in the mid-morning and then more at noon and then more in the middle of the afternoon and then more even 1 hour before the end of the workday, hires more people. And in the evening, they all got paid the same. So the ones who had been working all day were incensed that everybody else who came later, including people who only worked for an hour, all got paid just as much. If you're talking about microeconomics, that's a catastrophe. But Jesus telling a parable about the kingdom of heaven, if that's what it is, then the daily wage is already so infinitely rewarding, so eternal, so holy, so mysterious, so strange, powerful, and extremely loud in the ocean of your soul, that there is no way, nor is there any reason, to imagine trying to parcel it out in percentages or prorating it based on how long anyone has been a disciple. It's not about you got this, so proportionately I should get this. It's about everybody having enough. The breathtakingly extravagant provision of God. What is the bread that God is giving you to eat? In the second and third chapters of Ezekiel, God says to Ezekiel in a vision, "Open your mouth and eat what I give you." And Ezekiel says, "I looked and a hand was stretched out to me and a written scroll was in it. He spread it before me. It had writing on the front and back. And God said, 'Eat this scroll and go speak to the house of Israel. Eat this scroll that I give you and fill your stomach with it.' Then I ate it, and in my mouth it was sweet as honey." What is God giving you to eat? In her poem called "My Name Is Not Those People," Julia K. Dinsmore, who spoke from the lived experience of being in the cycle of poverty, both when she wrote this and still today, as far as I know, wrote, "I live with an income of $621 with $169 in food stamps for three kids. Rent is $585. That leaves $36 a month to live on. I am such a genius at surviving, I could balance the state budget in an hour. Never mind that there's a lack of living wage jobs. Never mind that it's impossible to be the sole emotional, social, spiritual, and economic support for a family. Never mind that parents are losing their children to gangs, drugs, stealing, prostitution, the poverty industry, social workers, kidnapping, the streets, the predator. My love is powerful, and the urge to keep my children alive will never stop. All children need homes and people who love them. All children need safety and the chance to be the people they were born to be. The wind will stop before I allow my sons to become a statistic. Before you give in to the urge to blame me, the blame that lets us go blind and unknowing into the isolation that disconnects your humanity from mine, take another look. Don't go away. For I am not the problem, but the solution." No Christian finds it acceptable. There is no theology that can be accurately described as Christian in which it is acceptable that people live and die in hunger and poverty because of where or to whom or in what circumstances they were born. We will all together be reminded of that again on Christmas Day, when we remember a bedraggled family, kept out of human comfort to sleep in the garage with the animals, who will bring into the world the fragile embodiment of God's promise to rain bread from heaven in a historic but nondescript town called Beit Lechem, the house of bread. And we will remember that God said to the Israelites who were lost and wandering and displaced and disoriented, hungry for something, "I am going to rain bread from heaven for you, and you will know that I am God."